This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
And while more than 220,000 people in Massachusetts are still without power, you can't help but to feel that we here in the Bay State really dodged a disaster. By the numbers alone, Hurricane Sandy is a record-breaking check on hubris.
From the Mid-Atlantic region north to New England, more than 7 million people are now without power. At least 35 died. Economic damages from the storm could be at least $20 billion. Meteorologists are calling Sandy one of the most powerful hurricanes ever to hit the eastern seaboard.
And when you hear that it will take days for New York and New Jersey to get up and running again, perhaps the most sobering aspect of this storm were all those images on television and over Instagram of the Manhattan skyline last night. In the blink of an eye, one of the world's great cities went dark.
And it could have been us. Maybe one day it will be again. According to a report issued last week by Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey, since the 1940s, extreme rain and snowfall events have increased by 85% in New England.
That brings up two words that haven't really been part of the political conversation this year: climate change. Climate change is probably part of the picture when looking at the aftermath of Sandy, but how much of the picture? And what does it mean for New England weather 5 years, 10 years, or 50 years from now? And is this superstorm, Sandy's size and its power, a harbinger of things to come? And listeners, what do you think? Why has climate change fallen out of our national conversation? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, because we're going to be talking about climate change and Hurricane Sandy for the next few minutes. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now is Beth Daly, environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. She wrote about climate change and Hurricane Sandy and New England in today's Globe. Beth, always great to see you. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel. She's a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She joins us today from Washington. Dr. Eckwurzel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So, Beth, let's start with you. You've been environment reporter for the Globe for a long time. Before we get deep into the science, what was your impression of Sandy yesterday here in New England?
It was impressive. It was really impressive for what I expected, because I was tracking it all day and I sort of thought it would miss us, and it did. But the winds and the waves were incredibly powerful, and I started thinking about climate change as it was sort of coming up the coast, and decided to write a story about it because it was so powerful. And it seemed that in the back of my head and everyone's head, there's this idea that warm water, as we all know, fuels more severe storms.
So walk me through one or two of the other additional aspects of climate change as has been measured that may have been part of the picture as to why Sandy was, you know, so big and so powerful.
Right. So let me just say that a lot of scientists often say, and you hear this phrase a lot, like, this one storm can't be attributed to climate change. And this is, of course, absolutely true. But the opposite is sort of true, that climate change is so much part of the sort of the foundation of our weather system. It's sort of hard to tease it out and say it's not related to climate change. But for Sandy, there were a couple things that were happening that are very, very important about its path and how it got here. First, it started in the Caribbean, and extraordinarily warm waters along the East Coast fueled its travels north. A blocking system, which is, many people feel, is related to climate change, sort of then help the jet stream dip very low and sort of wrap around Sandy and tug it west, actually. Those two ways, climate change is part of the Sandy story. The impacts are also very important, and I think Brenda will speak to this more eloquently, but New England and the Northeast are in this very vulnerable spot. Sea levels are rising 3 to 4 times faster here compared to global rates. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a storm, regardless of, quote, the exact cause, you're going to have storm surges that are riding on top of those higher seas.
Well, Brenda Eckwurzel, let's go into some of the science just a little bit deeper. As Beth mentioned, for example, the engine that provides the power for hurricanes is the one of the things is the relative temperature of sea surface along the Atlantic on the eastern seaboard. How do we know how much the sea surface has to rise before it really does have an effect on how much more powerful hurricanes get?
Well, in the case of Hurricane Sandy, Beth is absolutely right. The sea surface temperatures were a factor. Basically, Hurricane Sandy retained much of its strength as it tracked across the ocean. It was coming northward along the east coast of the U.S. And it hit waters that were 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average for this time of year. And that's remarkable. There's a certain threshold of water temperature that hurricanes need in order to thrive. And normally when hurricanes move in northern North Atlantic waters, we expect them to start cooling down. But these waters were hot enough for it to survive as a hurricane category one, and at points the hurricane hunter from NOAA was flying in parts of it and was approaching the strength of a category two. It didn't quite reach it, but it's really, really means a lot of damage, because power of a hurricane, wind speed and the power, it's on the power of 2 to 3 times damage can result from incremental increases in the wind speed. It's a power law.
Before we look at other aspects of climate change and sort of this part of the world, 9 degrees seems to be a huge amount for of an increase in sea surface temperature. There has been an overall long-term trend of warmer waters, but was this a particular spike?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Go ahead.
There's been a gradual increase of sea surface temperatures in the Northwest Atlantic. Actually, the Gulf of Maine is sort of an unusual story about that. It's actually been colder sometimes. But it's been gradual. But this year, it just spiked. It went off the charts. And it was, as anyone who went swimming off the coast of Cape Cod or even Maine felt the warmth. It retained its warmth for a really long time. And it didn't just sort of mess with Sandy in a lot of ways. It messed with a lot of things, and you have this sort of trend of cod stocks moving north and other things happening off our coast that are related to the warming temperatures.
Brenda Eckwurzel, there's another point that Beth brought up, and that is just the overall height of the oceans, especially off the coast of New England. And that also seems to be something that's a long-term, on an upward trend, and we're going to have bigger storm surges regardless if it's a hurricane or not.
Yeah, I'm really glad your listeners are hearing these facts that not many people are covering when you look at the coverage so far. But locally in the Mid-Atlantic and up to New England area, the sea level rise is among the highest in the world. It is much, much higher locally. And global sea level rise, because of human-induced climate change, we're warming the oceans, they expand. We also are melting glaciers, ice sheets, that fresh water is running off, adding volume to the oceans. They're causing sea level rise. But it doesn't rise the same everywhere. And New England has a double whammy in the global sea level rise and the local acceleration that's happening. It's among the highest in the world.
The one thing I would also like to mention is that Sandy is sort of part of this long-term pattern we see of extreme weather. There's been numerous studies out in New England and globally of the increase of more severe weather. And what does that mean? And in more extreme weather, that means the droughts come, they're stronger. They last maybe a little bit longer. When it rains, it just rains really hard. It rains harder. So because warmer air can hold more water vapor, there's more precipitation falling. So you have sort of all these interesting things happening also with the climate that will also lead to just sort of more fiercer storms overall. Did they contribute directly to Sandy? Well, you can't say anything is direct, but the evidence is mounting, and it's very clear, and the research of attribution is really increasing too to link these storms to climate change.
Well, on that note, Brenda Eckwurzel, let me ask you. I was reading some analysis from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and right there on one of their pages on hurricane activity, they asked the question: has global warming affected Atlantic hurricane activity? And the conclusion seems to be that global warming or climate change by the end of the 21st century, and this is straight from the website, will likely cause hurricanes to have substantially higher rainfall rates, one of the things that Beth was pointing out too, and also that it may not be the frequency of storms which increases, but rather their relative intensity. So does that make sense to you, that we're looking at a future where it doesn't really matter how many storms we have, but that we have to be bracing for bigger and more powerful ones more frequently, more often?
That's the crux of it. People get very concerned about how often are these going to happen. My concern is when these storms occur, they're more likely to be more powerful and more damaging. And for the most part, especially on the eastern seaboard, our sewers and roads and transportation networks were built for our grandparents' climate. But when it comes to climate change, city planners need to be our first responders. And I start getting very, very scared when I see some of these strong, powerful tropical depressions turning into tropical storms and then turning into a hurricane heading towards any U.S. coastal city on the eastern seaboard or the Gulf, because I know that the steps have not been taken to adequately protect citizens from these storms. And they're riding in on a higher sea level. Benjamin Franklin has measured data from a late October storm. It's a rare event, but it has happened. But it's a very different sea level that these storms are riding in on. And the storm surge that hit New York City, the infrastructure was built for storms of the past. And so it was hitting on a full moon. It hit at high tide, that storm surge, and it brought water levels up to around 13.8, 13.9 feet at the Battery. And so that's record-breaking, and that's more than the Great Hurricane in 1821.
Listeners, we are talking about Hurricane Sandy, about climate change, about the current state of the science around climate change and hurricanes, and about the current state of the conversation when it comes to how Americans view this issue, climate change. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm speaking with Brenda Eckwurzel. She's climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She joins us today from Washington. And with Beth Daly, environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. She's here with us in the Radio Boston studios today. Beth, let me ask you, I was looking at a report that was released a couple weeks ago by Munich Re. It's one of the world's largest reinsurance firms. And they have this study titled Severe Weather in North America. And in it, they conclude that, quote, nowhere in the world is the rising number of natural catastrophes more evident than in North America. And they have this astounding number that between 1980 and 2011, the overall losses, economic losses from weather catastrophes was over $1 trillion in the United States. I mean, just those two numbers, that one number in and of itself is pretty astounding. Which makes me wonder, why do you think that climate change and the issue of the cost, for example, of all these weather catastrophes really hasn't been part of this year's political conversation?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So it sort of gets a little bit into big agriculture right now and crop insurance, which is a really big deal for a lot of farmers out there. And they have a powerful lobby. I mean, that's over here, and that's one thing. But that's also why it's not being talked about. It's seen, those big losses are seen as sort of to a narrow group of people, and because they're being compensated for it, it's maybe on other people's backs, but it's not, it hasn't come to the general sort of public's sort of attention, I think. And I also think, obviously, the climate discussion has sort of fallen off the radar screen on a lot of politicians because it's too hot to touch. You know, it's considered so partisan now, you can't simply talk about it. I was actually, one of the most ironic things that had happened these past few days is that there's actually been a climate vigil in Government Center where 200 people have been staffed around the clock to basically get, hopefully, the presidential candidates to talk about climate, but mostly Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown, who've not really talked about it whatsoever. And unfortunately, the climate vigil was canceled because of Sandy. It was canceled for the very storm they say is linked to climate change. And still, there's been no talk today by politicians.
This is really interesting to me, Brenda Eckwurzel, because I completely hear what Beth is saying when climate change is seen to be a partisan issue. But also, as she's saying, when the weather hits, there's nothing partisan about it at all. It hits everybody. And yet, at the same time, you know, for example, President Obama himself, he hasn't brought the climate change up as an issue really at all this election season.
It's all couched in terms of energy efficiency, which is a very important topic, and advancing our new energy economy, which is something that we can all do. We can all increase our energy efficiency and reduce our heat trapping emissions to the atmosphere. That buys us more time so that we can build the infrastructure to protect ourselves from these more extreme events, as Beth was mentioning. There is very high confidence that certain extreme events are powerfully linked to climate change. They are heat waves, coastal flooding, intense precipitation, and droughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we've seen such catastrophic droughts over the past, 18 months or so. Why is it that even when, Texas, Oklahoma, much of the American Southwest, South and Midwest was withering over the course of the summer, even then it didn't really come up as an issue?
Well, it's ironic that, in fact, while the 2012, these extremes are being studied and the scientists are crunching the numbers, they'll be published, these extreme events will be published in the summer of 2012, in 2013. Just like in this summer, we were reading papers and publishing on what happened in 2011 and the Texas drought of 2011, very strong evidence, very strong links to climate change. But unfortunately, it's a huge undertaking to run these models without climate change because we've backing that out and trying to run them just with natural factors and seeing what are the likelihood, how intense would it be. When you add climate change back in many, many cases, these events are stronger, more persistent, as Beth said. Hmm. And that's something that we might not know it today, but the insurance industry folks that we have met with, I was at a special meeting on attribution of climate extremes, they said, we don't care if we have it 6 months later because we sign contracts annually and we can send price signals to commercial properties and to private citizens because if we don't send those signals, then people are going to have what's called maladaptive practices. If we continue to build on flood zones or continue to put ourselves in harm's way or don't put our buildings up on stilts if they are experiencing recurrent flooding, then the insurance industry is very concerned about that, as well as I'm very concerned about people's lives and property being put at risk.
It's interesting. I was in Lubbock, Texas for a conference a few weeks ago at the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference, which is an annual conference. And there were a lot of field trips up to farms. And, the drought of 2011 was on everyone's mind. Everyone was talking about it. But it's sort of like, yes, it was bad. And yes, we didn't like it. But when you really talk to people, including my husband had gone on a field trip to Koch Industries, which is Koch brothers, you may know, are considered mm-hmm. to be large climate skeptics. And asking them on the farm, what about the drought? Do you see it linked as part of this larger trend? There was this great resistance. And I can only attribute it to this partisan issue that it was not. It was part of this natural variability thing that we keep hearing about when the evidence just feels so overwhelming that you can't just say that anymore.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let's roll through a bunch of them if we can. Ari is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Ari.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me on the air. I was just wondering, what are the views on, a lot of talk has been said, a lot of things have been said by politicians over the last almost 20 years of climate change. And, there's things that are said at full extent both in the North and the South, as well as the West. My question is, in your view, what is the actual probability of anything being implemented at a full-scale level, even a small-scale level, to try to fix climate change both locally as well as, globally? And how well will that be, how much positive nature will that be, do you think that would be met by different factions of people in the United States, much less the world?
Ari, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to turn that briefly to Brenda Eckwurzel. I mean, I can think of two PACs at least, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative here in the Northeast, and also globally, maybe it's time, a lot of people have forgotten, there was the Kyoto Protocols as well.
Yes, I think New England region is really a leader in the nation right now because it's the only regional sector cap on electricity emissions. And some studies have shown that those states that took those dividends from the sale of that exchange and keeping a cap on electricity emissions, reducing heat trapping emissions to the atmosphere, those states that reinvested that in more energy efficiency measures, those states are seeing a higher economic growth, even during this recession, than those who gave the money back as a straight dividend check to every citizen. And so reinvesting in clean energy, investing in energy efficiency is really good for the economy, and it also helps slow the pace of climate change, which is really critical. And there are personal actions that people can take. We looked into this because we know that pace of national change is slow, and so we're looking to regional solutions such as in New England and in California and individual options and trying to look at that. And we looked at some of those and we said if every person living in the United States were to reduce their personal emissions of heat-trapping emissions by 20%, so we know what we each emit, that would be the equivalent of turning off 200 of the 600 coal-fired power plants powering our electricity grid.
But Brenda Eckmarzel and Beth Daly, let me ask you, isn't that exactly the point? I mean, if we're hoping that, you know, we can achieve this major change by getting everyone to do, I know it's theoretical, but to make certain changes to their lives, and the nation as a whole isn't even really talking about climate change at all, I mean, that seems to be totally unrealistic that we've actually fallen completely behind when it comes to people's awareness or even judgment of the importance of climate change, Beth.
Yeah, so I actually agree with that. Actually, I wrote this story really quickly yesterday on for the Globe about this sort of this climate change linked. But I had a really hard time getting people to talk about it, even including scientists, because of, I mean, not union concerned scientists, of course, but because I think that there's just such a reticence to, again, because of the partisan issue. But I have to say this idea of personal responsibility is interesting, and it's great that we all reduce, you know, our emissions by 20% and we all do what we can. But, you know, honestly, it doesn't appear to be anything of substance will happen. Let's just try to regulation.
Brenda Eckwurzel, we've just got a couple seconds to go, but I do wonder, since you've, you know, committed yourself and your career to this, what do you think it'll take to get politicians to really start talking about climate change again?
When we start showing our stories of personal action, and we want to ask our leaders to start leading and not ignoring this, because it really is not a partisan issue. As a colleague has said, you know, the atmosphere does not care where these heat-trapping emissions come from. It's trapping heat for all of us and causing extreme events around the world and in the United States. We should not lose any life or to extreme events. We should be better at protecting our citizens.
Brenda Eckwurzel is a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She joined us today from Washington. Brenda Eckwurzel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Beth Daly, environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. Always great to see you. Thanks for your reporting, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, there are a lot of you who wanted to call in. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of you, but please do send us your comments about climate change and Hurricane Sandy at radioboston.org. There's a lot to talk about. Well, stay with us because coming up, we'll remember the 100th anniversary of the death of Bram Stoker, the Irish author who gave us Dracula. In all this Sandy coverage, we should remember that tomorrow is Halloween. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.